actually brought back into the command module. The filtering system on the lunar module is designed to take this out. I might also mention that prior to ingressing, getting back in the lunar module from the lunar surface, the crew did kick their boots on the porch to knock off just as much as they could of that dust. However, again, the filtering system is designed to take that dust out as a precautionary measure.
Now, when they dock, Bill, will there be a pressure difference between the command module and the Eagle?
The pressure will be just about the same. There could be a difference, but it'll be very, very minor. The only thing that will be unpressurized will be the tunnel, and that'll have to be pressurized after they dock.
The differential pressure will be in favor of the direction from the command module to the lunar module, however, the slight difference.
Oh, as the hatch is open,
there will be a
positive pressure in the command module with respect to the lunar module. Now, that's done to ensure that the flow of air is from the command module to the lunar module, leaving any of this particulate matter in the LEM.
The Voice of America, broadcasting throughout the world with continuing coverage of the moon landing flight of Apollo 11. Now 126 hours and 28 minutes into that flight. The lunar spacecraft Eagle on its way back up to rendezvous and dock with the mother spacecraft Columbia. That should come in about an hour and 30 minutes from now at 21 hours 32 Greenwich Mean Time. This program is originating in Washington.
Would you like to have a color photograph of the three Apollo 11 astronauts? We would be happy to send you one if you write to The Voice of America, Washington, D.C., USA, Box 8108. Citizens of the United States are not eligible.
This is The Voice of America. We will return to our live coverage of the mission of Apollo 11 following this report of late world news.
The Jodrell Bank Observatory in Britain reports that the Soviet Union's unmanned Luna 15 spacecraft landed on the moon. But Sir Bernard Lovell, head of the tracking station, says he doubts whether it landed intact, since it was traveling at about 480 kilometers a minute. If Luna 15 hit the surface at that speed, Sir Lovell said, nothing is likely to survive such a landing. But it does not mean a complete crash landing. Sir Lovell said it is possible that Luna's radio transmitter had been programmed to switch off before touchdown or, as he put it, that something was ejected that would continue operating. Luna landed in the Sea of Crisis, about 800 kilometers from the site of Apollo 11 in the Sea of Tranquility. The Soviet Union has made no comment about the latest maneuver of the spacecraft, which was launched July 13th. President Nixon interrupted his moon mission watch today to confer with Gerard Smith, head of the United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. News Secretary Ronald Ziegler said they discussed subjects expected to come up in the proposed United States-Soviet talks on limitation of strategic arms. He added that the president has not yet heard from Soviet officials on a date or meeting place. But he said Mr. Nixon hopes the talks will begin sometime between the end of July and August 15th. The United States will issue new regulations Wednesday, easing restrictions on travel to Communist China and trade with that country. A State Department spokesman said Americans abroad would be permitted to bring into the United States limited quantities of goods originating in Communist China for non-commercial purposes. And he said the new regulations will authorize validation of passports for travel to China for certain categories of people. These include congressmen, journalists, teachers, scholars, college students, physicians, scientists, and Red Cross representatives. Israel and Egypt engaged in several exchanges of artillery fire along the Suez Canal today, including the Bitter Lake. Israel said two of its soldiers were wounded. Earlier today, Israel denied an Egyptian report of heavy Israeli shelling of the city of Suez at the southern tip of the waterway. An official announcement from Lagos reports that the Nigerian Air Force destroyed two gun-running aircraft yesterday over Biafra's Uli airstrip. Describing the fight as a decisive, fierce air battle, the Federal Information Ministry said one of the planes exploded in the air when hit and crashed in flames on the runway. Earlier, Radio Biafra claimed Biafran troops had recaptured a town near their former capital, Umuahia, and had penetrated the southern suburbs of Umuahia. There has been no comment from Lagos on the Biafran report. From Nairobi, Kenya, a Reuters news bulletin reports that Nairobi police have arrested a man on charges of murdering Tom Mboya, Kenya's economic and planning minister. Mr. Mboya was shot to death a little over 2 weeks ago while shopping in Nairobi. Police gave no further details, but said their investigation is continuing. Reverend A.D. Williams King was found dead in a swimming pool at his home in Atlanta, Georgia, today. Mr. King was a longtime civil rights leader and the only brother of the late Dr. Martin Luther King. He was a member of the board of directors of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and co-pastor with his father of the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta. A spokesman for the civil rights group said Mr. King arrived home late last night and went for a swim. He said the body was found this morning by three of his children. The cause of death is not known. International experts today opened a four-day meeting in Venice on ways to prevent the famous city of canals from sinking further into the sea. Since 1908, the foundations of the Italian city have sunk more than 13 centimeters. It is estimated that at the present rate, two-thirds of Venice will be underwater by 1990. The large proportion of young people in developing nations is causing increasingly severe labor problems, and education is not the answer. This is the warning given by a government study group in London today. It notes that Africa, Latin America, and Asia have twice as many people under the age of 16 as do Western Europe and North America. In about 10 years, there will be three times the number of people entering the labor market as there are leaving it. The Overseas Development Ministry reported that African nations are learning what Asian nations already know, that education in itself does not ensure a job. The Polish parliament today marked the 25th anniversary of communist rule by approving an amnesty pardoning minor offenses and reducing sentences by 50% for some more serious crimes. United Press International reported the amnesty did not cover crimes against the state. President Nixon told newsmen at the White House that the interest overseas in the moon journey seems to be as great as it is in America. And he said he has received an enormous number of messages from world leaders. That is the news. This is Paul Parks reporting on the Voice of America.
From the Apollo News Center in Washington, the Voice of America is broadcasting worldwide. Live coverage of the flight of Apollo 11 from Washington, from the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas. That flight, now 126 hours and 36 minutes old. Now to recap for a moment the events of the past few hours. About 2 hours and 15 minutes ago, or to be more precise, at 17 hours 54 Greenwich Mean Time, we had the very successful liftoff of Eagle, the lunar landing craft, from the surface of the moon, a very critical maneuver in this lunar landing and return flight. Liftoff, a 7-minute ascent from the surface of the moon, then into a low lunar orbit. An orbital change, several orbital changes in the past couple of hours. These changes and maneuvers are continuing. We're about 1 hour and 20 minutes from redocking. That should come at 21 hours 30 Greenwich Mean Time. This would complete one of the major phases of this flight. After redocking, there would be two major events. what we call TEI, the trans-Earth injection, and putting the command spacecraft into or out of lunar orbit and on its path back to Earth. And of course, that splashdown in the mid-Pacific Ocean is scheduled for Thursday, July 24th, at approximately 12:51 our time. That would be about 16 hours, 51 Greenwich Mean Time. Now, for a late status report, let's go to correspondent Rhett Turner in Houston.
We just got an announcement from Terry White, the voice of Apollo Control at this point, indicating another 25 minutes until ignition for TPI, terminal phase initiation. This comes at 20 hours 29 Greenwich Mean Time, according to our calculations. The lunar module will go around behind the moon just 3 minutes after this TPI. We will hear them begin the terminal phase initiation about 3 minutes before loss of signal. Mike Collins in Columbia remaining passive in a slightly higher orbit as they go around the left or west limb of the moon. This terminal phase initiation will be designed to move the lunar module Eagle up into a 60.5 nautical mile orbit, or cause it to reach an apolune or high point in its orbit of 60.5 nautical miles. This should roughly coincide with that of the lunar module. The exact moment of the beginning of TPI is determined by the angle that the lunar module is pointed in relation to his local horizon, comparing the angle of the moon in front of him in the direction of motion with the angle of the command module above that horizon. When that angle from horizon to the command module reaches 27 degrees, that is the moment when the lunar module is supposed to begin thrusting straight up toward the command module. All this is designed to make it as easy as possible for the pilots to do this piloting and at the same time to take advantage of the great amounts of energy being exchanged or transferred here in allowing the lunar module to move up alongside the command module. This is one of those very, very important things that Buzz Aldrin helped to devise in his doctor's dissertation on the orbital mechanics of rendezvous, and something which was perfected back in the Gemini flights. Wally Schirra was the first one to do this sort of rendezvous. You're hearing, I think that was Buzz Aldrin who made a comment there, the signal cutting out slightly. Couldn't quite catch that last word. If they say something, we will try to interpret it. That's Buzz Aldrin's transmission there. It's cutting out just a bit. Incidentally, I'd like to mention the fact that the recovery forces in the Pacific and the Atlantic are hanging with us here. They say the signal is very clear, both in the Pacific and in the Atlantic. Some 2,200 men on the aircraft carrier Hornet and on the Ozark, a mine countermeasures warfare ship in the Atlantic. They've been at sea for almost the whole month of July, some 800 men there. They're off the equator, off Brazil, listening to us and following the events of this exciting mission to the moon. And we're very glad that they're with us. We're glad the signal is clear and that the mission has progressed so well. Good luck to you men on the Hornet and on the Ozark and all the other support forces and the recovery troops in the Atlantic and the Pacific. We hope the signal stays loud and clear all the way to splashdown. We're continuing to wait 20 minutes until ignition of TPI, until that begins. We'll stand by, Bill.
We'll be returning to the Manned Spacecraft Center for further reports from correspondent Rhett Turner and Apollo Mission Control as the Eagle, the lunar landing craft, completes this latest maneuver, as Rhett Turner reported in about 20 minutes from now. Norm Guerin?
Bill, I was going to ask Rhett Turner a question. Apparently, the problems of gas bubbles in the astronauts' drinking water supply has been solved this mission. Rhett Turner, do you have any information about this?
It's been solved largely in one way, and it's presented a problem in another. There is a device which is attached to the water dispenser system, which removes the hydrogen bubbles. However, the astronauts discovered early in the flight, during that coast period between the Earth and the Moon, that when they inject a small nozzle device from this hydrogen remover into one of the food bags, there's just a little bit of back pressure from one of the food containers, which causes a blob of water to come out of the water dispenser after the bag is removed. So several times they've had just a little blob of water about the size of a good-sized coin to be hanging right in midair inside the command module after they fill up the food container. They can wipe it up, of course, if they're ready with a tissue of some sort.
Do you just reach out into the midair there and squash it with
apparently,
with a tissue?
If you touch the globule of water with a tissue, with one of these absorbent tissues, it will be absorbed and it can be stowed away.
Would you call it a space blotter, Rhett?
A space blotter, sure, John. it was rather amusing to the astronauts. Mike Collins seemed to give us the clearest description of that a few nights ago during that Earth-to-Moon coast phase. I've heard not another word about it since, so I don't know if they've just decided to forget it and are going ahead and blotting it up, living with it, or if they figured out some way to prevent the back pressure from the food bags.
Well, the other device was a plastic bag of sorts. What form is this particular device they're using now, Red?
You mean the spinning bag?
Yes.
I haven't heard of them using it on this mission. That was an expedient used in Apollos 9 and 10, in which food or actually water is pumped into one of the food bags or one of the water bags, and the bag has two compartments, and if you hold one end of it and spin it, getting a very clear word there from Mike Collins.
We haven't been on a final one yet. The last one was...
That's Buzz Aldrin in
standby.
The lab, saying standby. Each of the spacecraft, again, communicating between themselves for data on the next thrusting maneuver. Mike continuing to prepare those mirror image burn figures or thrusting figures in order to come get them if the lunar module thrusters don't work properly. They're still about 200 kilometers apart. And in 16 minutes from now, 16 minutes and 55 seconds, we should get the beginning.
Let me know when TPI 6 can be. I appreciate a call.
That's Mike Collins.
Okay.
I think he has his high gain antenna up, coming through loud and clear. Well, back to what I was saying, Norm.
Last I got was
the food bag.
2 seconds earlier than mine.
The food bag or water bag with two compartments. Supposedly, when you spin the bag from one corner, the water would go down into the bottom part through centrifugal force, and the lighter gas would remain in the top compartment. Gene Cernan, for one, said he almost rotated himself in reverse while trying to spin the bag. I haven't heard of him trying to use that on this mission. He had to spin it so hard that the gas would not separate. And George Lowe, here in Houston, at the Manned Spacecraft Center, the man in charge of spacecraft development, he spent considerable time over there in the Mission Control Center twirling one of these bags. I heard he got a good physical exercise from it.
Well, we're about 18 minutes away, I believe. Are we not, Rhett? You have the time clock there.
15 minutes, 46 seconds until the beginning of terminal phase initiation, TPI.
All of us, of course, remember the first American to fly an orbital mission in outer space. He was Colonel John Glenn in the Mercury capsule Friendship 7 on February 20th, 1962. Colonel Glenn has since retired from the astronaut program, but he has never lost his enthusiasm for the space program, as demonstrated in this conversation heard earlier on Sunday evening when VOA's Albert Johnson contacted Colonel Glenn by telephone at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston.
Colonel Glenn, it's a true pleasure to have you with us.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm glad to be able to participate and say hello again to so many people all over the world through the Voice of America.
Now, what was your reaction when you heard that announcement today? The Eagle has landed. How did you, as a former astronaut, feel?
Well, that was great. I think that whole approach to the landing, just that must rank right up with the greatest experiences that man has ever had, obviously. And that final approach where they were coming down and where Buzz Aldrin was calling off the altitudes one after the other, and their drift rate across the lunar surface as they were making the approach for a landing, that just had to be, there just aren't words to describe how we felt on that one, and how everyone that was sharing this all over the world and other nations too felt right along with us, I know.
What did you do at that time?
Well,
did you shout or what?
No, I think along with everyone else here in the center, I was just so intent on what was going on that you didn't really have time to think of anything else except just sort of concentrating on what the fellows were doing up there in the approach for landing.
Well, Colonel Glenn, perhaps you have some personal pangs of regret. If it hadn't been for a fall in a bathroom, it might be that perhaps you would have been one of the astronauts to make that moon landing. Did you think about that at all?
I think we all would like to. I don't think there's anyone that has any real red blood left in him wouldn't like to be on a flight like this, of course. But, you know, there are no regrets or anything like that. I'm just very happy, and I feel very fortunate that I was able to participate in the space program at all, and that, say I had been 10 years younger, maybe I wouldn't have been picked for the program at all. So I have no regrets, and it's just it's a tremendous experience, and of course everyone that's had anything to do with the space program is envious of the fellows up there now. They couldn't help but be. I would love to be on the flight, as would everyone else, and all the engineers and technicians and everyone else that's been connected with the program. But this flight has gone to them, and they are doing just an outstanding job, and we're just very happy to be able to share this with people all over the world, because all the people in the program really, really, truly look at it as a program that does represent, more represents mankind than just only a national program here. And we've looked at our program that way right from the early days. And so I know when I have had the opportunity to travel to many different countries and in my travels for the space program and in business, I've been in 34 countries in the last 3 years. And so I've had a chance to meet many, many different people. So I know from firsthand experience the interest that people all over the world have in this program. And one of the beautiful things about it is that there's nothing in it that is secret. We've been able to share this. And this whole program up to now has really been that of really developing a transportation system and putting it all together and testing it over and over again in stages. And this flight, of course, is the one where the system finally is coming into its own. It's finally being used for the first time as a whole complete transportation system to go into space and really do things. And now we hope we can look forward to using it for many different scientific purposes and experiments and can make these things really flying laboratories so that we maximize the return of information from space. For that's really the purpose of the program is the research and the exploration that goes on that can benefit all mankind. And I think that the space race that gets talked about so much is really of very, very secondary importance. The main thing is that this is the beginning of a big flow of information and knowledge back that can be used by people all over the world, and we have no idea yet what the benefit of this may be. We're just at the starting point, just stepping off, and it's like exploring here on Earth, or it's like conducting research in a laboratory, but no one has any vision right now, really, of what value this will be as new things are discovered and new principles and new experiments, and so that's rather a long-winded speech I didn't really mean to get into here. I'll turn it back to you here for a second, but that's really the status of the program right now.
Well, I think it only illustrates vocally, Colonel Glenn, the fact that you haven't lost your enthusiasm, nor your interest, nor the vitality of your own being in the outer space program, whether it be American or whether it be an international type of program.
Well, you know, I think our man makes progress, if we could be a little philosophical here just for a second, man makes progress only by his own curiosity. And that's true whether it's in the space program or how to develop better teachers or doctors or librarians or farmers or whatever. Man makes his progress by being curious about the unknown and by learning new facts and by then putting them to use. And that's really the purpose of this program. Here we as a nation, for the first time, have been able to mount such a big program in exercising our curiosity about what is up above the atmosphere and what we can discover and how can we control weather here on Earth and how can we do Earth resources programs and what is on the moon and how do cosmic rays react up there above our atmosphere and just a million and one things that we're curious about, and that this curiosity is really what all of man's progress is based on.
Well, Colonel Glenn, a number of scientists have suggested rather strenuously that for a period of time, the likelihood is, in their opinions, that man himself does not need to be, nor does he belong in space. How do you feel about this,
well,
man
I've
himself?
Well, I've never looked at the manned or the unmanned programs as being as competitive as most people seem to think they are. I've looked at them as being complementary. I think no matter how far man goes in space, he always will still be sending out probes and unmanned vehicles ahead of him, ahead of his own explorations. To find out what is there and to be as safe in his own explorations as possible. But I think man going into this new space, this new laboratory, if you will, to conduct his own research, can learn so much more. After all, man is the only, if you want to call him an instrument, he's the only instrument that can really perceive the new and analyze it on the spot and relate it to his own existence and his own back to his own Earth as to what is useful.
Well, there was a very good example of that when the lunar module was landed by astronaut Neil Armstrong.
Yes,
he had to make a decision in a matter of 1 minute where he was going to park his vehicle. And if
this had been just an unmanned landing there and come down in the rocks that he originally was making his approach on, why, it probably would have had we don't know what might have happened.
Before we conclude this telephone conversation, Colonel Glenn, perhaps you could make a bit of a quick comparison for us between the Mercury capsule in which you made your three orbits around the Earth and the type of equipment aboard Apollo 11. Could we make this comparison that your Mercury capsule was something like the Conestoga wagons which the American pioneers dragged across the Western Plains?
Too far off on that one. Of course, the trying to compare two different spacecraft is a difficult thing because they're designed for different jobs. And each, of course, was in its own time was out on the cutting edge of science or was out in the advance of what we knew how to do at that particular time. Of course, this whole and one thing leads to another. You know, it's like saying that compare one of the early automobiles and a modern Indianapolis racer or a huge truck now. There just is no comparison because they're, while they are sort of sisters or brothers under the skin, nevertheless they are, they're designed to do different things and designed with a different purpose. So each one of these things leads to another one, though. When Al Shepard made his suborbital flight, I build on his information for my flight, and subsequent flights after mine went into Gemini, and they build on my experience, and so on up the line. Back in those days, of course, the things that we were trying to discover were things such as, could man even operate intelligently in this new area of space, in a weightless environment? And we were interested in such what look as though very elementary things now, but in that time we were interested in such things as whether the shape of the eyeball even changes in a weightless state over a number of hours, because the base of the eye then is no longer needed to support the fluid in the eye. So the doctors wondered whether the eyeball actually changed shape. So we had a number of just similar, very elementary questions about whether man could function in that new environment of space and what his limitations were, what his capabilities were, and also how to design spacecraft to accommodate the man. And these were the things that we were trying to answer. Once we knew those problems, or knew the answers to those things, which we did determine in Mercury, then we could go on to Gemini, in which the major objectives were long-term weightlessness of periods up to 2 weeks, and also developing the rendezvous capability for spacecraft that was necessary before we could go on to designing something like this lunar vehicle that just landed on the moon today. So each project had its own purpose and a different purpose in its own time period. So it's difficult to just go back and say, compare the Mercury spacecraft with this one, because there isn't. It's a difficult thing to do. Each had its own purpose, and each was in a different time period.
Colonel John Glenn, we want to thank you very much for this exclusive telephone interview, which you've had, you and the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas, and we here in Washington. We are most grateful.
Albert Johnson of the Voice of America staff talking with Colonel John Glenn. This is the Voice of America broadcasting throughout the world with live coverage of the flight of Apollo 11. Now, about 5 minutes away from terminal phase initiation, with the Eagle lunar spacecraft closing in ever closer to the mother ship Columbia for rendezvous and redocking. This program is originating in Washington. We will return to our live Voice of America coverage of the mission of Apollo 11 following this report of Late World News.
President Nixon is preparing to leave on his worldwide tour tomorrow night, which will take him first to the Pacific Ocean for the splashdown of the Apollo 11 astronauts. Today, the president interrupted his moon watch to confer with Gerard Smith, the head of the United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. They discuss subjects expected to come up in the proposed U.S.-Soviet arms talks. The United States is relaxing travel and trade restrictions with Communist China. A State Department spokesman said Americans abroad would be allowed to bring limited quantities of red Chinese goods into the United States. He said passports will be issued to certain categories of people for travel to China. These would include congressmen, college students, and teachers. The Jodrell Bank Observatory in Britain reports that the Soviet Union's unmanned Luna 15 spacecraft landed on the moon. But a spokesman said he doubts if the spacecraft landed intact, since it was traveling at about 480 kilometers per hour. Here in Washington, a congressional committee approved a major tax reform by cutting the controversial oil depletion allowance given to the petroleum industry. The House Ways and Means Committee cut the exemption from 27.5% to 20%. The Polish Parliament celebrated the 25th anniversary of communist rule by approving an amnesty for persons convicted of minor offenses and reducing sentences for serious crimes. The amnesty did not include persons convicted of crimes against the state. Kenyan police are holding a man they suspect murdered Kenyan Minister of Planning and Economic Development, Tom Mboya, 2 weeks ago on a Nairobi street. The suspect was arraigned today. Algerian President Boumed Diene described the first Pan-African festival as the greatest assembly of arts and letters ever held on the continent. He spoke at the opening ceremonies for the festival in Algiers. In Hong Kong, a fire swept the British freighter Eastern Star. 11 seamen are missing and are presumed dead. 13 others were injured. The fire broke out when a welding torch set off a gas explosion. The White House has been besieged by a flood of goodwill messages from world leaders on the Apollo 11 mission. President Nixon said interest overseas seems to be as great as it is in America. That is the news in brief. This is Paul Parks reporting on the Voice of America.
From the VOA Apollo News Center in Washington, live coverage of the flight of Apollo 11. Now about 1 minute and 30 seconds away from TPI, the terminal phase initiation, bringing Eagle to rendezvous and docking with the mother spacecraft Columbia. To Houston and correspondent Rhett Turner.
We've been getting continuous updates on the expected time of TPI. As I reported earlier, it's really determined by the moment or the second when the angle of the view from the lunar module to the command module is 27 degrees above the horizon, above and ahead of their relative motion. This is expected now at 127 hours, 3 minutes, 30 seconds. Or about 1 minute and 20 seconds from now. These figures have been changing constantly during the past half hour as Mission Control follows the onboard calculations of both the lunar module and the command module. Mike Collins just got the word from Neil Armstrong a moment ago that he saw some slight out-of-plane motion between the two craft. They are tracking each other. They're about 70 kilometers apart. Mike says, coming up on 1 minute, how is it looking? Neil says, pretty good. Let's stay tuned into this.
That out-of-plane was in the eggs, not in the radar.
The out-of-plane indication was in the abort guidance system, the alignment of it, and not in the radar. The rendezvous radar is solidly locked on between the lunar module Eagle and command module Columbia. You'll probably hear a good bit of conversation and exchange of data between Eagle and Columbia here. 25 seconds until expected ignition. Again, that's up to Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin on board the lunar module. 1 minute and 50 seconds until the limb goes around behind the moon. This TPI coming a little later than expected. 7 seconds. 5. We'll stand by for any communications. Mark. They should reach that point and begin thrusting. A delta velocity of 24.9 feet per second. Burn time on the RCS thrusters of some 22 and a half seconds expected to begin causing the lunar module to move up into a higher orbit above the lunar surface.
We're burning.
We're burning, says attaboy. Neil Armstrong. Mike says, attaboy. 29 seconds, 30. When we say we're burning, of course, that means that the rocket thrusters, the small RCS thrusters on the lunar module are firing. I had a layman to comment one time that that was a fearsome thought to hear that phrase. However, in space, you will hear space pilots use that constantly. We're burning the rocket thrusters. Should have completed that by now. Burn complete, says Armstrong.
Burn complete.
Roger, thank you.
Eagle Houston, half on me, low fixed rate, and we'll see you at 127 plus 51.
20 seconds until loss of signal. Not time enough for a burn report. I don't know if that noise means we have now lost signal with the LEM or not. We'll wait for confirmation. Oh, boy. I know we've lost signal now from the sound of that very noisy transmitter link, which we're monitoring here at the Mission Control Center in Houston. The small thrusters on the lunar module carrying the load now. The acid engine did its job in one mighty 7-minute burn period, exerting 3,500 pounds of thrust, putting the lunar module Eagle up off the surface of the moon into orbit, and now beginning the completion phase of rendezvous, TPI, terminal phase initiation of the rendezvous. All of this will occur out behind the moon, out of touch. Here's
Mission
Control.
This is Apollo Control. We've apparently had loss of signal with Columbia and Eagle as they went behind the moon on the 26th revolution. Next maneuver scheduled for about 33 minutes from now. While both vehicles are behind the moon, this will be the braking series of maneuvers coming down to docking, or station keeping first, and then docking in about 128 hours, ground elapsed time. And at 127 hours, 6 minutes, ground elapsed time, and the flight of Apollo 11, this is Mission Control.
That report from inside the Mission Control room from Terry White, you could hear the busy conversation of all of the flight engineers as they're at their consoles monitoring these events. And interestingly enough, another one of the major events in the mission is occurring behind the moon while both spacecraft are out of touch with the Earth. The astronauts are strictly on their own at this point, having received all of the guidance and updating assistance possible from the Mission Control Center, and they will complete the rendezvous, pull up alongside, and they should be station keeping or formation flying by the time we hear from them 43 minutes, 50 seconds from now. Bill McCrory?
The Voice of America's continuing live coverage of the flight of Apollo 11. We'll be returning, of course, to the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas, as soon as we reacquire signal from the spacecraft. We have loss of signal now for roughly about 45 minutes, about the time they are coming back on the other side of the moon. They should be near rendezvous and docking, that final maneuver that we've been waiting for several hours. Norm Guerin?
Well, Bill, following the mission, splashdown, there will be a quarantine period, this to protect the biosphere. Following landing and recovery, the Apollo 11 astronauts, once aboard the carrier Hornet, will be placed in a mobile quarantine facility called MQF for short. They'll be isolated in this small receiving laboratory until they reach the lunar receiving laboratory in Houston. John Hirosaki is the recovery engineer who will enter the mobile quarantine facility and remain with the astronauts during the entire quarantine. I traveled to Houston earlier in the month and had this conversation with him.
Mr. Hirosaki, as a recovery engineer, you've worked closely with the development of the MQF, the Mobile Quarantine Facility, which is a very important part of the recovery operation. In fact, the second big step after the astronauts are removed from the command module and placed aboard the carrier. Just what is a mobile quarantine facility?
The mobile quarantine facility is a facility that was designed to house the astronauts and their support personnel for return from the recovery area back to the Lunar Receiving Lab in Houston, Texas. It essentially is 35 feet long, roughly 9 foot high and 9 foot wide. Has living facilities for medical debriefing, for sleeping, eating, and all necessary support equipment to support these personnel.
Well, tell me, what was the major engineering concern in designing this facility?
The prime concern was to maintain biological isolation of the personnel inside the mobile quarantine facility. In other words, we're trying to isolate the personnel or the astronauts once they return back from the lunar surface during this interim phase between the recovery area and the lunar receiving laboratory.
How long will the astronauts actually be quarantined in the MQF?
On this mission, we anticipate roughly 3 days.
And how many people will it support for what length of time?
The MQF was designed to support 6 people for 10 days.
I understand that you will be aboard the mobile quarantine facility with the astronauts. What will be your particular function, John, during that time?
Well, there are several. My prime function is to maintain all of the mobile quarantine facility systems and to perform all necessary operations on the spacecraft and the lunar samples. This includes removal of the samples and packaging and processing for return to the lunar receiving lab in Houston. Also, there is assistance required for medical debriefing operations as well as photography.
Well, you'll have to be passing food, equipment, and samples into the facility. How do you do that? Would you explain that for us?
We have a double door transfer lock, as it is called, and essentially it's a chamber which can be flooded with a decontaminant solution with a door on the inside and a door on the outside with an interlock mechanism. The item to be transferred out is placed in special containers. It's then placed inside the transfer lock and closed. The lock area is then flooded with decontaminant solution for a fixed period of time and then drained. At that time, the outer door can be opened and the sample removed.
Well, what special preparation do you have to take into consideration with food that will be passed in so as not to break the quarantine? Is this specially prepared?
That is correct. The food is specially prepared and selected by people here at MSC. This food was prepared under controlled conditions, kept frozen until it is passed into the MQF. Once it is in the MQF, then it is reheated by a microwave oven and fed to the crew.
How many of the MQFs will be deployed for recovery?
On this mission, we are planning to deploy 2 units.
It occurs to me that you will have many vehicles dealing with this particular facility. Did you have to take into consideration a matching of power supplies as you went from one stage to the other until you returned this small laboratory to the Manned Space Center here in Houston?
That is correct. But during our design development phase, we had to incorporate the different power modes anticipated on board the ship in transit as well as on board aircraft. And these facilities have been incorporated inside the unit.
Thank you very much, John Hirasaki, recovery engineer, Manned Space Flight Center, Houston. This is Norman Guerin.
This is the Voice of America with continuing live coverage of the flight of Apollo 11. Now 127 hours and 13 minutes into that flight. At the moment, the two spacecraft, Eagle and Columbia, are on the backside of the moon, outside of communications. It will be some 30 minutes, or 40 minutes actually, before we reacquire signal. Perhaps we can recap as to just what has been happening over the last few hours. We had a highly successful liftoff, the firing of the ascent engine of the Eagle off the surface of the moon at 17 hours 54 Greenwich Mean Time, after a stay of some 21 hours and 36 minutes on the lunar surface. For the past several hours, we have had the orbital maneuvers performed by the Eagle spacecraft. These maneuvers catching up with the mother spacecraft, orbiting the moon at 110 kilometers above the surface. We will have the what we call the terminal phase finalization, TPF, at 21 hours 15 or 5:15 our time in Washington. This followed by the actual redocking of the two craft, bringing to a close this particular phase of the 8-day flight of Apollo 11. A critical phase, the firing of that big ascent engine, and with the 1,500 kilograms of thrust, actually it wasn't such a large engine, but enough to get it off the surface of the moon, back into orbit, and of course the orbital maneuvers, the rendezvous techniques, now taking it up to the mother spacecraft, Columbia. Well, gentlemen, listening to Norman Guerin's interview with Mr. Hirasaki on the mobile quarantine facility brings to mind that this particular flight will be quite different in the after the splashdown as we look back on all the others, the Mercury flights, the Gemini flights, and the Apollo 7, 8, 9, and 10, the four Apollo flights. Normally, we would see the three astronauts coming out of the spacecraft in the water on into the helicopter in their space suits, or actually their, what do you call the undercover suit, John, there?
Constant wear garment.
Constant wear garment. Well, that is a good name for it. But none of the quarantine precautions that have to be taken because these men have landed on the moon. There's, of course, the precaution against contamination, either contamination of we here on Earth or of the men themselves, the lunar samples, everything that they're bringing back. Could we go through some of the quarantine precautions that they're taking, beginning with that splashdown, Norm?
Bill, number one, if I'm not mistaken, I think the quarantine is already officially in effect. That started when the hatch was closed.
Yes.
Is that right, Bill?
As a matter of fact, it started before the hatch was closed on a lunar module when they started kicking off the dust that was remaining on their suits. And then they did ingress the lunar module and closed the hatch. And from that point on, there were procedures taking place. The initial procedures, of course, occur as the air is being circulated in the lunar module and taking out any particulate contamination, that is small particles of dust that are in the air. In fact, we heard a report earlier that they had to change to an auxiliary lithium hydroxide canister because the first one was not circulating air properly, and that was probably due to the fact that it had picked up some amount of this and caused the caused restrictions in the filter. That's the first stage. The next stage occurs after docking when, prior to transferring to the command module, they do a vacuum job on their suits and on their gear, and that also goes through a filter and is taken out of the their environment. When the hatch is open between the command module and the lunar module, there will be a larger or a greater pressure in the command module than that in the LEM. This greater pressure will cause airflow to be from the command module to the LEM, thus reducing the possibility of anything that might be remaining in the atmosphere of the LEM getting into the command module. And then the next step that is taken is that the suits that the crew wore on the surface of the moon are being, or would then be packaged up into packages along with the articles, film and cameras that will be transferred back to the command module, such that everything then in the command module that was exposed to the lunar surface will be in package form. Then as the command module returns to Earth, the 2-plus days after a docking maneuver, the air will continually be circulated in the command module, so anything that might have gotten in there from the LEM would be filtered out.
Bill,
again,
I was
through that filter.
Just looking at the, over the flight plan, and after that docking takes place, I see the word vacuum occurs about at least 3 times per page. They're vacuuming this piece of equipment, vacuuming that piece of equipment. So it's quite a thorough cleaning job on all of this, all of these items, in addition to the packaging.
That's right. And every precaution is taken at that point to remove the dust. And I can't remember the exact figure, but it was something like 10 to the minus 9th particles would remain after they return, which is like, it's like nothing. They expect practically a 100% cleansing job on all of the equipment and on the atmosphere prior to returning to Earth.
Now, when we do return to Earth, the splashdown in the Pacific, what are the precautions taken in the water? I know that they spray the spacecraft with a solution.
Yes, I believe, Bill, with an iodine base, if I'm not mistaken.
And what about the astronauts? They don a special...
The astronauts,
biomedical suit, or something.
That's right. They'll have a special suit that they'll wear. It's a thin suit, but it's complete with gloves and feet and mask, such that they will have no parts of their body exposed to the atmosphere when they egress the command module. The interesting part of the suit is that the 3 crew members will wear the suit. And so will one of the scuba divers, the one who is assisting. That's right, one of the swimmers who will be assisting them from the spacecraft to the raft. The interesting part of it is that the 3 crew members will wear suits that have filters to filter the air that they breathe out, such that all the air that they breathe out to the atmosphere will go through these filters. The swimmer, however, to be protected just the other way around, has his air filtered as it's coming in, so that even if he were to get very close to them, there would be no chance of exchanging any kind of germs.
Then they're transferred, of course, to the helicopter, but is the helicopter a kind of quarantine facility itself as they get aboard?
No, at that point, Bill, the quarantine facility is the garment that they're wearing, the suit, which consists of an enclosed environment about each of the crew members.
Then they're transferred, once aboard the ship, directly into the mobile quarantine facility. I've heard it described as something like a large house trailer. Norman Guerin, when you were in Houston, I believe you saw that facility.
That's quite a vivid description. It looks like a mobile home, minus the wheels, only it is much more sophisticated. It will be, I believe, slightly pressurized so that nothing can enter if there are any cracks. There are airlock doors.
Yeah,
is it the opposite direction?
The opposite direction. Slightly under pressure.
Under pressure.
Under pressure.
So that if there are any leaks, it leaks out.
Leaks out.
Leaks in.
Leaks in. Out. That's right.
And then it has the microwave oven, 6 or 7 aircraft seats, bunks, and really all the comforts of home, and a very sophisticated panel in which medical tests can be conducted.
Now, it's interesting that the aircraft seats are there, complete with seat belts, because they will be in this mobile quarantine facility as they're transported by air from Hawaii to Ellington Air Force Base, which is just adjacent to the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston.
In other words, this whole mobile quarantine facility is hoisted off the ship, apparently trucked to an airport, on board a truck, and then to the airport and on the plane?
That's right. And then when it reaches Houston, there's another truck, which is the exact height of the interlock door at the Lunar Receiving Lab.
This is the big semi-permanent laboratory at the Manned Spacecraft
Center.
That
is right, where they'll finish their quarantine.
The mobile quarantine facility, as you mentioned, Bill, will be hoisted off of the carrier, and that will occur just a little over 2 days. I think it's 55 hours from splashdown, according to the plan, at Hawaii. And then a truck will take it over to the airport, put it aboard a transport aircraft. That will take it to Ellington Air Force Base. Another tractor will drive it then from there to the Lunar Receiving Laboratory, which is the permanent facility that the crew will be quarantined within, the crew and all of the lunar samples.
And it has a very elaborate patching system, in as much as it will be on several power sources as it makes its way back to Houston.
That's right. It has its own power source, and then it uses the power sources of any of the transportation systems that it's connected with at the time. Like the on board the ship, it will use ship's power, and then it will be on its own, I believe, during the rest of the transit.
A very interesting phase, of course, in this lunar landing flight. And, of course, the samples themselves will be quarantined, will they not, along with the astronauts that are brought back and the spacecraft?
That's right, Bill. The samples that will be tested, the initial testing, will all be done. In fact, a great deal of testing will be done for some time thereafter, too, behind glass and behind an environmentally controlled vacuum chamber, or inside a chamber. And in order to work with it, the scientists will have to use mechanical devices, or in some cases, gloves that will keep them separated from the vacuum inside the chamber and keep that material away from touch.
This is the Voice of America, broadcasting throughout the world with live coverage of the flight of Apollo 11. Now 127 hours and 25 minutes into that flight. At the moment, the two spacecraft, Eagle and Columbia, are on the backside of the moon. We should have acquisition of signal in about 25 minutes from now. At that time, they should be very close to rendezvous and docking, a process that they have been going through now for about 3 hours, or 3.5 hours. The several orbital changes, starting, of course, with the liftoff at about 17 hours 54 Greenwich Mean Time into a low lunar orbit, a change to a circular orbit, and then the TPI, the terminal phase initiation, which will be coming at 21 hours 15 Greenwich Mean Time. And, of course, the actual redocking itself. Let's call in correspondent Noel. Let's see if Brett Turner, our correspondent, is in Houston for a very fast status report.
We should get acquisition of signal there in about 24 minutes, just a bit over 24 minutes from now. The terminal phase initiation, of course, was carried out just before we went around behind the moon, and there is a constant necessity for thrusting. The astronauts may fire the thrusters at any time they want to as they drift up closer and closer to the orbit of the command module. All this, of course, going on out of touch with the Earth. And by the time we hear from them again, now 23 minutes and 45 seconds from now, they should be alongside, flying in formation. That's it. This is just looking briefly at the timeline of the events from TPI to TPF, terminal phase finalization, which really means just braking to a stop side by side. That's about it. All is quiet here at the Mission Control Center. The engineers in the MCC, or the MOCR, M-O-C-R, as they call it, are quietly talking among themselves. We can see Phil Schaffer, the chief flight dynamics officer, who along with his men have expertly guided these two craft to the moon and given them all the help they can for this final rendezvous effort before the craft disappeared behind the moon.
And we should have that redocking in about 32 minutes from now. Astronauts Armstrong and Aldrin, who have successfully blasted off from the moon's Sea of Tranquility and headed for a rendezvous and link up with the command ship Columbia for the return to Earth. Within the hour, at 21 hours 32, Greenwich Mean Time, that link up is expected to be accomplished, and all three Apollo 11 crewmen will be together again for the triumphant journey home, and of course a rather permanent place in man's history. This program is originating in Washington.
The Voice of America has a limited supply of color photographs of the three Apollo 11 astronauts. If you would like one of these souvenir photos, write to The Voice of America, Washington, D.C., USA, Box 8108. Citizens of the United States are not eligible.
This is The Voice of America. We will return to our live coverage of the mission of Apollo 11 following this report of late world news.
The Jodrell Bank Observatory in Britain reports that the Soviet Union's unmanned Luna 15 spacecraft landed on the moon. But Sir Bernard Lovell, head of the tracking station, says he doubts whether it landed intact, since it was traveling at about 480 kilometers an hour. If Luna 15 hit the surface with that speed, Sir Bernard said, nothing is likely to survive such a landing, but it does not mean a complete crash landing. Sir Bernard said it is possible that Luna's radio transmitter had been programmed to switch off before touchdown, or, as he put it, that something was ejected that would continue operating. Luna 15 landed in the Sea of Crises, about 800 kilometers from the site of Apollo 11 in the Sea of Tranquility. The Soviet Union has made no comment about the latest maneuver of the spacecraft, which was launched July 13th. President Nixon interrupted his moon mission watch today to confer with Gerard Smith, head of the U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. New Secretary Ronald Ziegler said they discussed subjects expected to come up in the proposed U.S.-Soviet talks on limitation of strategic arms.